mead that caught the lightning flash and amplified it, expanded it, made my entire body warm. "Go on," I wrote. "I saw the face of God, Julie. He wants something from me. From you, too." "From me?" I could only retype the words. "From all of us," he wrote after a long time. The plan felt like a special project we were working on together, or a game. Whenever I was chatting with Charlie, or John David as I began to think of him, I existed in another dimension. In the beginning, I guarded the secret. My desktop monitor was visible from the doorway, and I jumped every time the floorboards creaked in the hall outside. But then I began to feel comfortable existing in both worlds at once. The ordinary world, which consisted of me eating dinner and finishing my homework, and going to track meets after school, and the world of the plan. In the ordinary world, I was Julie, maker of A's, runner of hurdle races. My grades stayed high, and I didn't drop my after-school activities. That was part of the plan. No dramatic behavior changes. I worked hard to keep my weight from dropping, too, but the pounds seemed to be falling off no matter how much of my dad's lasagna I ate. My mom blamed track and gave me extra helpings at every meal, but I knew it was the plan working in me, preparing me for something John David called privations to come. In the ordinary world, I was ordinary Julie, but in the plan, I was radiant. He told me that my loveliness was like a bruise in the exact center of a blinding light, like a sunspot. The fire of God shone around me. Even though we never met in person, never video chatted, too dangerous, he said, I knew he could see me. He said he saw me when he closed his eyes and prayed. He said he saw me standing in front of the sun with it shining all around me. And there were things he seemed to know about me that he could not possibly have gotten from the internet. He knew, for instance, when I started shaving my legs. I had to for track, even though my leg hair was barely there, just a glimmer in the sunlight, really. The other girls would have thought I was strange if I didn't shave. He didn't like the thought of me taking a blade to my legs. He told me that afterward, I wouldn't need to do things like that. Things to appease the world. I didn't know if he was close enough to be literally watching me or whether he was finding out some other way. I didn't want to know. Instead, I started pretending he could see me all the time, so I could wear his gaze like a secret under my clothes, against my skin. It made ordinary Julie a more exciting role somehow. I performed my ordinariness for him, putting on lip gloss in the bathroom, giggling with other girls, reading To Kill a Mockingbird with my feet propped up on the ottoman, helping Mom with the dishes after supper, brushing my hair, writing in my diary. All for him. I even made up some diary entries that were totally ordinary, just listing what I did during the day, things ordinary Julie did. I pretended to have a crush on this guy at school, Aaron. I felt sure Charlie knew how well I was performing my role, and I began to slip in little hints and references that only he would understand. I drew sheep on my binder and imagined him laughing at the joke. At the pep rally, I got a sun painted on my cheek so he'd see it and understand the message. No matter how much I looked like a teenage girl to the others, he was out there somewhere, and as long as he was watching, I was divine. The only time the two worlds touched each other was under the covers at night. Then I would try to whisper Jesus, and John David would come out instead. Once I dreamed I was falling, flying apart, breaking into a million pieces, becoming the darkness at the center of the light. I clenched my teeth and waited for it to be over. When I opened my eyes, there were red stars. That's when I realized I'd been in love with Charlie. A wave of shame rushed over me. It was stupid, the whole thing, a crush, too embarrassing even to think about on someone who could never think of me that way because I was a stupid little kid. Or at least that's how it had been, then. But I wasn't a kid anymore. The image of Charlie, faded now, seemed smaller than it had before. It had been months since I'd even seen his face. I did not have a schoolgirl crush any longer because I wasn't a schoolgirl. That was ordinary, Julie. I was divine. In our chats, the outline of a head and shoulders in the profile window reminded me of a blue shadow cast on the sidewalk by someone you can't see. The shadow was John David. And the everyday, ordinary Charlie who cast the shadow was no more important than the ordinary, everyday Julie. The embarrassing feelings were all for Charlie. John David was different. He was part of the light, surrounded by light. Not a shadow, but a real person standing directly in front of the sun, a person whose shape you can barely make out when you squint, hidden in blinding brightness. Tears came to my eyes and there was a warmth in my chest, burning in my heart. I closed my eyes and saw the form of John David shining, haloed, a bruise in the center of brightness. He had already changed me. Walking toward him on the road made by his shining, I melted into him, and our darkness became pure light. The plan was an anti-plan, really. It was going to be a total surrender to God. That was all I knew. John David promised we would surrender ourselves to the source of the light together and sink into the sea of his love, and we'd never have to make a plan of any kind ever again. One night I typed out the verse about the lilies of the field. He corrected me. "We won't be lilies," he wrote. "We'll be nothing. We'll be nothing at all." On the last night before the plan, Jane looked at me while we were brushing our teeth and said, "I know something about you." I was silent. I was counting to 100 like I always did when brushing. I could feel Jane's eyes on me in the bathroom mirror, but pretended I was alone so my face wouldn't move.
"You think nobody notices,"
Jane said, trying again. Foamy toothpaste dribbled out of her mouth and she spat it into the sink.
"You think you're so cool."
I did not think I was cool. My parents thought I was cool, my friends thought I was cool, and some of them were even cool themselves, but I wasn't. I only looked that way because of my friends, who were always calling me on the weekends to go to the mall, where somebody's older sibling would drop us off so we could try on halter tops at Wet Seal and smell all the perfumes at Sephora. There were slumber parties at Christian's house with the whole team, and late-night chats with Lauren or Maya, some of which had begun to revolve around Aaron. I wondered if this was what Jane thought she knew. The made-up crush on Aaron had begun to take on such a life of its own that sometimes, in a moment of confusion, I thought it was real. I refocused on the mirror and noticed that Jane was still staring. But this time her face was flushed and there were tears wobbling in her eyes.
"How come you don't like me anymore?"
I reached 100 just as the subject changed. It was not a coincidence. I knew by now. Nothing was. I leaned over and carefully spat into the sink, then straightened up and rubbed my mouth with the towel.
"Why do you think I don't like you?"
I asked.
"You could have just said, 'I do like you,'"
Jane sniffed.
"I do like you." "No, you don't,"
Jane went on. By this time, the tears were squeezing out of the corners of her eyes and tracking down her reddened cheeks. Jane cried all the time now. Mom said she was hitting puberty earlier than I had. And at least it was all going to be over sooner that way. In her old man pajamas, as I called them, the button-down flannel top and drawstring bottoms hanging off her, Jane looked bigger than me, even if she wasn't quite as tall yet. She didn't have boobs either, but there was something about her that looked like the beginning of something. Mom said she might even be taller than me soon. "I won't know," I thought with a pang.
"You're my sister," I explained. "I don't like you. I love you."
I had meant it to sound funny, but as I said it, I knew that it was true. We had played and fought and done everything together throughout our childhood. Jane throwing toys when I turned my back and ignored her. Me running to Mom when Jane wouldn't obey the rules of a board game, or when she quit because she wasn't winning. Tears started tickling my eyes, and I wondered automatically and dispassionately if I should let them fall, if doing so would benefit the plan.
How come you never want to hang out with me then? You're always hanging out with your new friends, and I have to stay home and watch TV by myself. You haven't even watched Beauty and the Beast with me once all summer.
That movie is kind of dumb, Jane, I said. It's a kid's movie.
It's not dumb. I like the songs.
Jane's favorite song was the one in the tavern. Whenever no one was paying attention to her, she'd start singing it, and if you didn't stop and do some of the voices with her, she would continue singing it louder and louder. Jane was never afraid to be annoying, never afraid to take up space. I'm not a little kid anymore, Jane. I don't like princesses and cartoons and stuff.
I miss you,
Jane said. Now the first tear came out, all of a sudden, after I'd thought the danger was over. I'm right here, I started to say, but the words stuck in my throat. I'll watch it with you this weekend, I said instead. I promise. And the lie somehow made me stronger, straightened me up. Ordinary Julie would be there Saturday morning to keep her promise, I told myself. Ordinary Julie would stay behind to see what happened with Jane, watch over her, help her with her homework, tell her not to wear something that would make the kids tease her at school.
Really?
Jane said.
Yeah, sure.
I looked back at the mirror.
What was the thing you were saying? What do you know about me?
Jane's tears were gone now. She didn't smile, but she managed to look as if she wanted to. I know you don't really like track, she said. I know you're only pretending to like it so you can fit in. I paused. I had never really thought about whether I liked track or not. It seemed so obvious that if you could play a sport, you should, whether or not you enjoyed it, because with a swarm of friends around you, any lie could become the truth. Suddenly I pitied Jane with her awkward face, every emotion going straight from her insides to her outside. Jane would never be good at sports, I thought. She wouldn't be popular in eighth grade like I was. Good night, I said, and I wrapped my arms around her for a moment, long enough to remind us both how much fun we used to have together. When I was ready to pull away, I counted to three first. Ordinary Julie wasn't enough for Jane. She always wanted a little more. That night, I woke up to a rough hand over my mouth. I tried to gasp, but couldn't, and still half asleep for a moment, I thought I was drowning. When I opened my eyes, there was a bearded man leaning over me. He nodded, and after a moment of paralysis, I nodded back, and he slowly, slowly removed his hand, keeping it near enough to clasp over my mouth again, should I scream. It was Charlie, but also not. His dark blonde hair was straggly and long, long enough for a ponytail. His beard was darker than his hair, and a mustache covered his mouth with shadows. He smelled sweet and sour at the same time, like the smell that came out of the recycling bin when I emptied it after school. That was my first impression of John David, and I immediately wanted to scream. But I was Plan Julie, and so I repeated over and over in my head, "It's not really kidnapping. It's not real. I'm running away to meet my destiny. This is what I was born for. I am being chosen. He is choosing me." I smiled at John David, trying to show him I remembered, I knew. If he smiled back, I couldn't see it under his beard. His hand trembled as he pulled the blankets off me and reached out to help me out of bed, but when I put out my hand, he wrapped his around my wrist instead and pulled me to my feet slowly but forcefully. We moved deliberately, playing the mirror game, flowing together across the floor, me anticipating his movements so that he wouldn't feel even a hint of resistance. I was so desperate to please him. My eyes did not leave his for a moment, as if we were dancing. His hand wrapped around my wrist, and the rest was all electrical current moving my feet silently across the floor. Then I saw what was in his other hand. Although the word knife had been part of the plan, I had never actually associated it with the knives hanging in the kitchen. I had never looked at any one of them and thought, knife, and pictured it in his hand. It drifted up slowly, almost lazily, until it was level with my chest, and I thought, he doesn't want to scare me, and tried even harder not to be scared. He circled around behind me and clamped his hand down on my shoulder. I felt the tip of the knife press into my back. Not hard enough to cut, but hard enough so its cold metal tip separated the fibers of my nightshirt. Now there was the relief of knowing exactly what to do, because there wasn't a choice. I thought I'd given up control when we'd started discussing the plan, but I hadn't. It had all been a game. But now, with him standing invisibly behind me, an unseen presence marching me forward with the pressure of a hand on my shoulder and the sharpness of a knife just to the right of my spine, I knew that the time to decide against the plan had passed. Thoughts floated through my mind that did not sit comfortably next to one another. For instance, I did not know where he was taking me, and where was Jane? Oh, safe in bed. Jane was safe in bed. She'd stay there forever, tucked into a life that would never change. Then Jane's face suddenly appeared. I caught sight of her as we approached the open door to her room. We usually slept with the doors open. I could barely see her hiding in her cracked open closet down low by the floor, looking at me with eyes that were not closed and warm with sleep, but wide and red-rimmed with terror. John David and I stood on the landing. Jane's face peered out at me from behind the closet door, desperately asking me what to do next. I motioned with my eyes toward John David and willed Jane to sink back into the closet's darkness before he saw her. If she screamed once, it would all be over. He would get her, too. And no matter where he was taking me, no matter what he was going to do to me, I would not let him do it to Jane. Just before John David marched me down the stairs, there was a noise from the attic. I felt the knife's point lessen its tension for just a moment, a hand on my shoulder twist ever so slightly, and knew John David was looking away. As quickly as I could, I raised my hand and put a finger to my lips. Shh. Pushing the soft, imaginary breath across the room to freeze Jane in place. Shh. And goodbye. Shh. And goodbye. And that is how I lost my family, my home, my life, and myself. Everything. Everything. In one night. 16. One afternoon when I was pregnant with Jane and Tom was off in an accounting class and we still lived in the little house near my university, Julie sat on the wood floor of the living room in a patch of sunlight. Her baby feet stuck out in front of her, and her wisps of hair were lit up white by the sun. She was concentrating on moving a blue crayon over a newspaper in front of her. When she accidentally squeezed the crayon too hard, and it skittered away, she didn't cry, and she didn't get another crayon, even though there were dozens lying all around her. She screwed her face up, made her fingers into clumsy pincers, scooted herself toward the rolling blue crayon, and recovered it. Then she resumed coloring until the whole cycle started over again. I watched her for maybe half an hour before it hit me. She likes the color blue. It was the first time I understood that there was a whole world in there I would never see. A world so distant from me and so distinct that to say that Julie was made from me, that she was my daughter and I was her mother, seemed meaningless. I think I loved her more profoundly in that moment than I have ever loved anyone. But that's memory for you. At first, I wanted the world for Julie, like all mothers do. Then, for a long time, I only wanted a body to bury. Now, I just wish I could go back in time and hand her the goddamn blue crayon. Reading through the transcript, devouring it, in fact, I learned the shape of her trauma. I study the names of all the girls she had to be to survive. Charlotte, Karen, Mercy, Star, Violet, Gretchen. In her testimony, they struggle, they fight, they fail, but above all, they survive. Even as I choke back tears, thinking of all she's been through, I hold each one dear, each of these girls, because each is a layer of my daughter, the one waiting at home with Tom. But the girl whose story hurts me most is Julie. She's the one I thought I knew, but didn't. Worse still, she's the one who knew me. Her words give me a picture of myself I don't recognize. I try to remember each moment she describes of her unfolding adolescence, to remember and possibly justify the role I played in it. But that feeling of otherness is monumental. I recognize the outlines of the situations, Jane and Tom and me reduced to characters in her story, but it's like seeing them, seeing us all, on an alien planet through an alien atmosphere. I try to remember Julie asking me about God, but I can't. Who was I? What was I doing that I can't remember? I was finishing up a postdoc, then interviewing for jobs. I knew she was laughing, but I thought she was laughing at me. My mom just sort of looked at me when I wore pretty clothes, her lips pressed together. I don't need a mirror to know what that expression looks like. I saw it on my mother's face over and over again. I didn't know it was on mine. I had the answer all worked out, but my mom never asked. I'd believed the girls were benefiting from my example, if not my undivided attention. I guess she never thought about how uncomfortable it was to walk 4 blocks in church flats. I read somewhere that Puritans would sometimes explain the death of a particularly beloved child as the parents' punishment for having loved the child too much. They blamed not the awful winters or the malarial swamps or the lack of good food or clean water, but a jealous God. I never loved Julie more than Jane. I can say that with confidence. At the same time, there was always something about her. She seemed so complete in herself, so serene. Somewhere deep down, I thought Julie was perfect. Now I wonder, was I so afraid of finding out she wasn't perfect that I almost killed her? When they unlock the cell door, they don't tell me where they are taking me. It's strange how little anyone tells prisoners outside of directing them to put their hands out to be cuffed and pointing them down hallways. I guess nobody wants to be responsible for sharing privileged information. I assume I am being taken to see my lawyer, because that's what has happened every other time I've been brought down this particular corridor. But this time we take a right instead of a left at the end and go through a door with a wired window in it. And then suddenly I am standing by the front desk as my cuffs are being removed. Tom stands there too, awkwardly, his hand fiddling nervously with his keys in his pants pocket. The guard says, "The charges have been dropped. Your things will be at the front desk in just a minute. You'll need to go over them and sign a paper saying everything's there." My eyes meet hers for only a moment before she looks away. Maybe it's hard for them to make eye contact with us after we're free. She disappears behind the door again, leaving us alone in the cramped waiting room, the woman who works the front desk presumably off rummaging for the box containing my clothes, my shoes, my purse with the book on Byron and landscape, still half-read, tucked inside it. I'm suddenly overwhelmed with a craving to finish it.
"Maxwell confessed," Tom says. "Apparently he was on psych meds for schizoaffective something or other. But they didn't know that at the hospital, so he didn't get any there. And before they could figure out what was wrong, he started talking to God about his sins."
"Bet Judge Crawford didn't know about the meds."
"No one did. Not even his top advisors. The drugs kept the worst symptoms under control, but..."
He looks down.
7 more victims have come forward."
7. And those are just the ones willing to talk to the police. "Thanks for coming," I say.
"There wasn't time to schedule a call," he says. "I guess once the charges are dropped, they're eager to get you off the taxpayer's dime."
"That makes sense." We stand in silence under the fluorescent lights.
"Anna,"
he says. "It's okay," I say.
"I'm sorry."
"It's not your fault," I say. "I wasn't there. I checked out."
"I shouldn't have let you,"
he says. "You're a good man," I say, too weary for this. "You always have to be helping someone. I didn't want your help, so you gave it to someone else."
"If I could take it back..."
"Don't say that," I interrupt. "Someone got her daughter back because of you. You wouldn't change that, so don't say you would because you think it'll please me. It won't." He looks stricken, and I soften despite myself. Honestly, Tom, I say, it's a relief to know that you're not an angel. It's a standard I could never live up to. I don't tell him how much it hurts to see him tumble from his pedestal. This is why people need God, because people are awful, even the good ones. I've always prided myself on being so rational, so unafflicted by spiritual yearnings, not realizing my personal gods were Tom and Julie, the good people. But nobody ever gets to be good except on the terms the world hands them. Finally, the front desk matron emerges with a plastic bag holding my clothes and purse. I poke through the bag and sign the papers. Then I take everything into a visitor's restroom, change back into my street clothes, fold the blue prison scrubs neatly in a pile. I reemerge looking something like myself again. Tom smiles. As I set the stack of prison pajamas on the front desk, I wonder if this is it for Tom and me. If he can smile this easily at the sight of me looking like I did before all this happened, if he can so quickly forget the image of me as a prisoner, then he is always going to misunderstand who I am and what I am. We exit into the bright sunlight. The sun is beating down on the Commerce Street port, and the air is scalding hot. Do you think Janie will come home? I ask, thinking of her first date with the guy on the kickball team. I haven't heard how it went. I resisted telling her to meet at a public place, to let a friend know where they were going. Tom looks uncomfortable.
She's staying up there for a while longer, Anna. She really wants to get back on track, finish all those incompletes, and show her professor she can tough it out.
He sighs.
I'm sorry. You know Janie.
I do know Janie. The incompletes were nothing more than a cry for attention, but she has terrible timing. Jane functions well under duress, gravitates toward drama, and can be generous as long as no one expects her to be. Then, when the water's still and her dramatics would be entertaining, she's back to her own world. I think of all the journals. Wait for it. She'll switch her major to creative writing before the year is out.
Why do you say that?
She'll want to start working on her memoirs. Tom laughs, still a little uneasy, as we get into the SUV. We make our way to I-10, the churning of the air conditioner at full blast, filling the silence. It's a little past 6, and the rush from downtown has mostly cleared, but when we hit Loop 610, the backup begins. The lowering sun, undaunted by our visors, beats down through the windshield, and the tinting in the back windows only seems to trap the heat. As we slow almost to a standstill somewhere around the Voss exit, the air conditioner, losing velocity from the incoming wind, thumps down a notch in intensity and gives a faint rattle. I wonder if this is going to be the summer the AC gives out on us. This is the stretch of road where that type of thing always happens. Suddenly I say, "Pull the car over.
We're getting off at the next exit. Pull over now."
He puts on his blinker. Traffic is sluggish, but he cuts across 3 lanes, nosing over and waving his hand like a flag in front of the rearview mirror. As soon as the tires thunk onto the shoulder, I open the door and Tom slams on the brakes as I stumble out. My stomach heaves up into my mouth and out onto the pavement. There's not a lot in there, I've barely been eating, but I heave and heave. My vision goes red in the heat and then black. And then Tom is there, on his knees behind me, with his big arms around me, supporting me. Waves of heat that reek of gasoline and vomit are coming up off the pavement, each one bringing a fresh wave of spasms with it. But his hands on me are warmer still. After a moment, I sink back into him like an armchair, and he settles down under my weight, and we sit together on the gravel at the side of the freeway.
"She left us, Tom," I say. But my voice disappears in the roadside symphony of honking horns and Doppler effects.
He continues to smooth my hair back over my sweating temple, but now, despite the heat, I am shivering, cold and hot at the same time. I pull away from him, turn toward his face. I say it louder, but he shakes his head, still not hearing. Finally, I lean toward him and force my mouth to open wide, and I yell at the top of my lungs, "Julie left!" This time he understands, but shakes his head back and forth in response.
"Come on,"
he shouts, and starts to make his way to standing,
holding out one hand to me and gesturing toward the car with the other. But yelling has freed something in me that was pressed into that dingy little cage of a jail cell for the past week. Julie's deposition is still banging around inside me, and if I don't let it out, it will punch holes in my lungs and I'll drown.
Tom!
I yell.
She left!
I know! He shouts back.
How can you be so calm?
I demand.
Come on, Anna, get in the car.
But it's easier to scream out here, and this is something I want to scream.
What kind of mother am I, Tom? I didn't know her at all!
What do you want me to do about it?
He yells back.
I didn't either. But I'm the mother!
Yes, you're the mother, he yells. You're the mother, and she needs you right now. So let's get in the car, for God's sake, and go home and yell it at her.
The adrenaline drains out of me, and I follow him to the Range Rover and get in, feeling the car shudder as the traffic going past starts to pick up. The quiet, when we shut the doors, feels profound.
You read the deposition, I say in a voice that is only slightly hoarse.
I didn't need to read it. I was there to hear most of it.
How could I have been so blind? How could I have missed all that? It's like I didn't know her at all.
I can't let the tears prickle up one more time today, so I press them down.
I know I've been broken since it happened. I know I've been awful with Jane, but I thought... Before that, I mean... I thought everything was good. I thought I was a good mother.
There's a long silence. Then he says,
I think it would have been good enough, Anna. But we'll never know now. None of us know who we would have been. He took that away from us.
Tom starts the engine, puts on his blinker, and forces the car out into the Houston traffic. He's a wonderfully aggressive driver. When we're moving again, he says,
Can I confess something?
I wait.
I wish it had been me who shot Maxwell.
I picture Tom the night Julie had her miscarriage, standing with the gun in his hand as I punched my fist through the bathroom door to get to my daughter. Then I lean over and take his hand. There's a car parked outside our house, and when we walk in the door, Julie is sitting at the kitchen table with an African-American man in a t-shirt and jeans. As soon as we walk in the door, he stands up.
Mom, Dad, this is Cal, Julie says.
Mr. Whittaker?
Cal extends a hand to Tom, who takes it, though he looks a bit bewildered. Cal is almost a head shorter than Tom, but he doesn't seem as if he's craning his neck up to meet Tom's gaze.
Glad to meet you, says Tom.
And I can see Cal scoping me out from the corner of his eye before turning to me.
Dr. DeVallos, he says.
Julie must have schooled him in how to address me.
I understand you helped Julie out of a tough situation, I say to Cal.
You did too,
he says, simply and warmly. I wonder, is this the rest of my life? Are all of Julie's men going to have to live up to me? And do any of them know she was poised with her gun ready to kill? Do they know what I really saved her from? People have a lack of imagination about women like Julie and what they're capable of. I was guilty of it myself once. I know better now, of course. But I would never disabuse the men in her life, the Toms and Cals, of the notion that Julie needs protecting. Fostering that illusion is part of how she's survived this long. To take away that coping mechanism before it has outlived its usefulness would be cruel. Cal looks to be older than her, though it's hard to tell how much, since his skin is unwrinkled everywhere but around his eyes when he smiles. I wonder if he will be with her on the day she outgrows the useful illusion of her frailty, and how he will react if he's still around. It might be a long time before that happens, a lifetime even. I may not live to see it myself.
Meanwhile, it'll be our secret.
It's very nice to meet you, Cal. Now, would you and Tom mind if I talked to Julie for a few minutes? I ask.
Alone?
Tom says,
I was just going to run up to the grocery store and get some stuff for dinner. Why don't you come along, Cal? We can get to know each other.
Sure, Cal says after a backward glance at Julie, who nods. The two men walk out of the kitchen. When they have been gone for a full 30 seconds, I look at my daughter. I don't know what I'm expecting. A revelation? To find out what color her eyes are once and for all? I see the same woman I've been looking at for the past month, as much of a mystery to me as ever.
Why didn't you come back? I ask. After you escaped from Maxwell. Why didn't you come home?
There's a long pause.
I wanted to. I was going to. But it seemed like once he did that to me, nothing went the way it was supposed to. Things kept happening.
I know some of the things she is talking about, and I don't want her to have to repeat them. At the same time, I don't want to shut her down ever again. So I wait patiently, and after a moment she goes on, giving me a strange look that I can't really interpret.
Besides, I didn't know whether you'd want me back.
I choke on my next words.
How can you say that?
I thought you'd be mad, she says with a weird smile. I hated Julie. She was stupid and gullible, and she left you.
You were only a child. He took you.
He took me, she agrees. But to me, it felt like I was leaving on my own.
That's what he wanted you to think.
And there was Charlotte. She was dead, and I was scared it was my fault.
He wanted you to think that, too.
Well, he was good at it. Or I was good at believing it. She shrugs, giving up. Anyway, I'm not sure it makes me feel any better if I didn't have a choice. If that's true, if I was just a random victim, then my life was ruined for no reason at all.
That, of course, is what I have always believed. I don't say it, but she can see me thinking it.
You've never believed in God. I don't think Jane does either. Maybe Dad doesn't care either way, but it was different for me. I wanted to find something out there. I still do. I just don't know the word for it.
Transcendence, I say. There's no such thing.
But maybe there is, she says. I don't know. Think of all those people at the gate.
I'd rather not.
But you have to, she says. You have to. What are they looking for? Why are they all so happy there? Where else could they find that kind of happiness?
Poetry, I say. Music, art.
That's not enough for everyone. It wasn't enough for me. Her face looks sad and eager at the same time, and I suddenly recognize a glimmer of an expression I remember from her childhood. I never knew what it was before. It reminds me of something.
Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come. I almost stop there, but for Julie's sake I finish. From God, who is our home. Wordsworth.
Why do you have to put quotation marks around it to understand it?
All I have is other people's words, Julie.
They are, at present, failing me. After another long moment of silence, it occurs to me that I have nothing to lose by just asking.
You came back for Maxwell because you saw that magazine profile, okay. But you didn't have to come back as Julie. If you were worried about being blamed for what happened with Charlotte, why didn't you just leave an anonymous tip for the police and let them take care of it?
Why did you come back to us after so long when you knew you would have to lie?
I take a deep breath.
Was it the money?
It's okay if it was.
She looks up, startled, with china blue eyes. I missed you, she says.
The worst doesn't unhappen, but just like that, I am home.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Good as Gone by Amy Gentry, performed by Karen Peaks. Directed by Jonathan Pennock. Performance copyright 2016 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com.
No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.